Hello, adventurers, for this next installment of the audio version of my memoir, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, I will be picking up from where we left and continuing with chapter 4 and seeing how far we get before my voice gives out and my jaw feels like it's going to break open. Chapter 4, Pregnancy, aka a fancy word for hell. I settled my feet on a stack of pillows and clicked on the nightstand light. Okay, baby girl, it's week 28. Let's see what the third trimester has in store for us. I cracked open my favorite pregnancy book and started reading about Braxton Hicks contractions and delivery. I could not wait for this pregnancy to be over. In the first trimester, I had discovered that morning sickness was not always limited to the morning and could in fact last all day. Once I got my arms around the fact that a man had probably coined the phrase morning sickness in order to get his wife back into the kitchen and making supper, I started counting the days to the second trimester, when the all-day sickness would end. The sickness, however, did not abate until several weeks into the second trimester. When it did, I was so relieved. Nathan and I planned a trip to Orlando to visit family and have some fun. The nausea returned with a vengeance as I was drinking a virgin strawberry daiquiri by the pool. I'll never drink another daiquiri. I prayed my stomach would return to normal after the birth. The constipation was even worse than the nausea. Around week 7, I felt my bowels grind to a stop. I did everything I could to reboot the system. I guzzled prune juice, various pink and green potions that my obstetrician recommended, and walked around our block. The pain was so bad that if my bowels had felt inspired during one of those walks, I would have gladly squatted on a neighbor's lawn. Day 3 of the great constipation ordeal, I could not pee. My bladder was ready to burst from all the prune juice I had been imbibing, but no matter how I squeezed or crouched above the toilet, only a few drops would trickle out. My obstetrician told me to go to the ER for a catheter. A concerned doctor listened to my stomach with his stethoscope. "Well, I believe you when you say you've been drinking prune juice. I can hear a lot of activity in there." That sounded promising. "But unfortunately, your plumbing is all blocked up, and nothing is coming out until we deal with that." That sounded less than promising. Pregnancy can be hard. I remember my wife had terrible constipation during her pregnancies. I could give you a catheter, but I think if we relieve the constipation, then your bladder will sort itself out. A kindly nurse arrived quickly and asked me to roll onto my side. This was my first experience with an enema, and I actually thought the nurse was going to squirt a liquid solution up my derriere. I was more than a little surprised to discover what an enema actually entailed. The nurse patted my shoulder. "Try to lie here for 10 minutes before using the bathroom." That would obviously not be a problem. After 3 days of constipation, I doubted the next 10 minutes would bring any relief. 3 minutes later, I practically skidded into a wall as I made my way to the bathroom down the hall. The constipation crisis was over. My humiliation, however, was just getting started. By the time we left the ER, it was 11 o'clock on a Sunday night. The doctor had given me a prescription for a bladder infection. Because if a pregnant lady shows up with constipation, I guess her urine needs to be tested as well. I wanted to fill the prescription immediately to keep our baby safe, but our local pharmacy was closed for the night. We had to drive to the next city to find a 24-hour pharmacy and wait another hour to fill my prescription. Not only were we both exhausted, we were famished, having left for the ER before dinner. As we waited and waited, I wandered the store. In the gastrointestinal aisle, I spotted a box of enemas. The warning on the box cautioned that pregnant women should not use the enema unless directed to do so by a physician, and my physician had told me to go to the ER, but I still blamed myself. I had been living off white bread, cheddar cheese, and more white bread to manage the nausea. I should have known that would make me constipated. My cheeks burned. Was this all in my head? Was I being a hypochondriac? Since college, I had done my best to conceal the hypochondria, but I knew the truth. If I got a headache, I worried it was a tumor. When I got a cold, I fretted my immune system was collapsing, and though I knew in my rational brain that I was extra sensitive to arachnids, I still suspected Airfy spider bite was actually a flesh-eating virus. Everyone, my husband, obstetrician, the nurses, and doctor at the ER, must think I was so pathetic and weak for needing to go to the hospital for a little constipation. I should have been stronger and found a way to resolve the problem on my own. Hospitals were for severed limbs and deadly viruses. They were not for hypochondriacs who overreacted to something simple like constipation. I resolved to do a better job of being the master of my body. After the ER trip, I started eating double fiber bread and apples to make sure my bowels stayed happy. This aggravated the nausea, but between puking and constipation, one must always, always choose vomit. A little before Thanksgiving, though, I got cocky. I was halfway through the pregnancy and sick of nausea. Surely I can mix some bland foods with the fiber. And then again, maybe not. This time I ended up in my obstetrician's office. I could do a catheter. Last time I just needed an enema. That relieved all the pressure and then I could urinate. My obstetrician winced. Don't have any enemas. That's okay. I brought one, I said, pulling the box out of my purse. I was a Girl Scout. My doctor inserted the enema. I waited as long as possible. And then, did you know enemas do not always work? Enemas do not always work. I was afraid this might happen, my doctor said. I wonder if you have MS. Multiple sclerosis, I yelped. Was I dying? Would my baby be okay? Would Nathan have to be a single dad? And for the love of all things holy and sacred, could we please do something about the constipation before we sorted through the possible neurological underpinnings? Not to worry, that was next. Since the enema did not work, I'm afraid I will have to manually extract the excrement. I turned onto my right side, and the doctor lifted my paper gown. When she put her gloved hand up my rectum, it hurt. But the humiliation was far worse than the pain. As the room filled with the smell of my poop, the doctor said, I'm a little concerned. You say you can't have a bowel movement, but your feces is actually quite soft. Based on your description, it should be hard. To my ears, it sounded as if the doctor did not believe me. She was probably just puzzled, but in my already humiliated state, I assumed she thought the constipation was a figment of my imagination. Tears filled my eyes. I had tried to poop. Believe me, I had tried. Pregnancy hormones do crazy things. They make women weep, drool, fart, and even eat dirt. In my case, the hormones had made the business of bowel movements a little more difficult. Still, I blamed myself. I'd like you to see a gastroenterologist to rule out something more serious. Lovely. My obstetrician seemed to share my view that I was either a hypochondriac or dying of an obscure illness. A month later, a gastroenterologist assured me the constipation was just a pregnancy symptom. It's severe, but still on a normal spectrum. So it's not MS? No, you don't have MS. Relief flooded my body. You will most likely experience more constipation and hemorrhoids after childbirth. And there went the sense of relief. Is there anything else I can do to prevent that? I'm going to give you a list of things you can do while you are pregnant, but constipation after pregnancy is inevitable. Oh, good, I thought, as I left the office. Another opportunity for me to be utterly humiliated and act like a pathetic hypochondriac. I thumbed through the third trimester pages, noting topics of interest. Braxton Hicks contractions. That sounds sci-fi. Oh, vaginal discharge. Lovely. Frequent urination. Even more frequent than it already is. Well, isn't that exciting? There was an entire chapter devoted to breastfeeding. I had already bought several books about the lactation arts and registered for a breastfeeding class, but made a note to read the chapter with a highlighter and pen. There were also several chapters devoted to labor and delivery. Those would require meticulous studying. My hand flew to my stomach. Pippa had started kicking. Even though my uterus registered every thump, it was still cool to feel the force of her foot banging against my fingers. We had picked her name weeks before her first kick, a few days after the expensive blood test revealed we were having a girl. It was a Saturday in early September, and Nathan was watching college football while I flipped through some baby name books. After a couple of hours of entertaining various names, we agreed that Pippa sounded right. I frowned for my spot on the couch. So do we have to name her Philippa? Of course not. That was holding! Nathan turned back to me. We will just name her Pippa. I like that. But since Pippa is quirky, let's give her a solid middle name, like Anne. Nathan paused the game. You know I love the name Anne. But it has to be Anne with an E. We had not told anyone else, but ever since that Saturday, our baby's name was Pippa Ann Novak. Of course, we said we were open to other names. We still had over two trimesters to discuss, but there never were any other contenders. Now, with just one trimester to go, she was most definitely Pippa Ann. Pippa was still kicking. Are you going to be a soccer player? Or a dancer? I'm so excited to see who you want to be. I spent a lot of time these days laying in bed, surrounded by pillows and reading pregnancy books. The law firm I had been working for from home had recently hired some new attorneys. My services were no longer needed. I was going to be a stay-at-home mom and was ready to be done with the law, so the timing could not have been better. A little before Christmas, I had finished the first draft of my novel. My sister had read it and given me a ton of ideas to make it better, and I had created an extensive checklist of revisions I wanted to make. Those, however, would have to wait until after the baby arrived. Revisions and nausea do not mix. But hey, at least newborns nap a lot. There would be time enough for writing once Pippa was here. Meconium? Poop that's like tar? Gross. We'll just let Daddy change those first diapers, okay? Pippa kicked. We were already co-conspirators. I flipped through the chapters about the first weeks with a newborn. Oh, here's some ideas for the registry. I don't think we need a diaper bag, do you? No, they are too frumpy. What about a baby carrier? Would you like me to carry you in a sling? Pippa stopped kicking. She was saving her strength for the midnight hour. The baby blues. I skimmed a few paragraphs. Pippa, this says 80% of new moms get the baby blues. Well, that is not going to happen to Mommy. You'll see, Mommy hardly ever cries. I'll be so happy to finally have you here in my arms, I won't have time to be sad. I turned the page. A heading in bold immediately grabbed my attention. Postpartum depression. For a moment, it seemed as if someone had hit the pause button on the universe. I stopped breathing, and everything became very, very quiet. I can't explain why or how, but it was almost as if some part of me knew what was going to happen after Pippa was born. I started to read. Extreme sadness, low energy, crying episodes, but quickly turned to the next page. Sitting on my bed, 28 weeks pregnant, and reading up on the postpartum period, I was not about to pay attention to irrational premonitions or put any silly ideas into my head. It was bad enough that I had to worry about postpartum constipation. My inner hypochondriac would have a field day if I knew the symptoms for postpartum depression. How are you doing? The obstetrician had just arrived to check on my progress. The contractions just started hurting again. I need the anesthesiologist to give me another refresher. I was in a private labor and delivery room at the hospital. The room was larger than any room in our house and had dark wood paneling on the walls. It felt more like a nice hotel room than a room for giving birth. Nathan and I had been in this room, sleeping and watching movies for the past 18 hours. My water had broken the night before, a little after 11 p.m. I had been asleep and woke up to use the bathroom. After I finished peeing, a trickle of water kept coming out of me. My due date was 11 days away, so my first thought was that I had broken my bladder. It took me a minute to realize what had happened, and when I did, excited adrenaline flooded my body. I would have run to wake Nathan if I had been capable of anything more than a waddle. He was out of bed before I could finish the sentence. I think my water broke. My contractions had not yet started, but my obstetrician told me to head straight to the hospital. This did not surprise me. At the beginning of the pregnancy, I had tested positive for Group B strep infection, a bacteria that tons of healthy women have in their digestive tract. The bacteria can occasionally make a newborn sick, so my doctor had warned me multiple times that I would need to take antibiotics intravenously as soon as my water broke. On our way to the hospital, Nathan played Europe's The Final Countdown on his phone. Our baby was coming! Before I was admitted to the labor and delivery ward, the nurses had to confirm that I was actually in labor. I had a queasy feeling I was going to be sent home with an admonition to stop pissing myself. A nurse, though, tested the liquid coming out of me and confirmed it was amniotic fluid. She hooked me up to a machine and said I was, in fact, having regular contractions. Every time the machine registered a contraction, more liquid whooshed out of me. Still, I felt nothing. I was a goddess. Contractions could not hurt me. 10 hours later, the contractions were so bad I wanted to die. My sister called. We had talked several times since my water broke. During the first several calls, I sounded cheerful and upbeat. About 10 hours into labor, though, I sounded as if I had been possessed by a demon. At least, so my sister says. I myself have no memory of that conversation. All I remember from that stage of labor was the delivery nurse's suggestion I wait a little longer for an epidural. I was only 4 centimeters dilated, and she thought I should wait until I was at least 5 centimeters. My obstetrician, however, had told me to get the epidural as soon as I wanted. I was not going to be a hero and wait for the 5-centimeter mark. The anesthesiologist had applauded my aversion to pain as he administered the epidural. Now it was 9 p.m. Approximately 22 hours had passed since my water broke. The pain was back, and I wanted it to go away. My obstetrician, though, thought otherwise. You are 10 centimeters dilated. She was standing at the head of my hospital bed. It is time to push. It will be a lot easier if you can feel the contractions. But I want another epidural. Honey, the nurse said, you will be able to push better if you can feel the contractions. I looked at my doctor. So it's better to feel the pain? I think so. Okay. And that is how I, a woman fully committed to having an epidural, entered the final stage of labor sans pain medication. Chapter 5, in which my adventures with postpartum depression begin. Theoretically, I was supposed to push whenever a contraction started. The labor and delivery class had glossed over this part, the teacher insisting everything would make sense when the time to push arrived. That time had arrived. Nothing made sense. With each contraction, I experimented with a different technique. It was like trying to do a squat without the benefit of ever seeing how someone actually performed that exercise. After several tries, I finally did something right. "That's it, Courtney, that's it," my doctor said. "That's exactly how you need to push." I panted and looked at Nathan. He smiled. Then I noticed the nurse was busy by my tush, cleaning up a mess. Poop. She was cleaning up my poop. Various authorities had warned me that I would probably poop on the delivery table. But I am a well-mannered woman, thank you very much, and my manners include holding doors open, saying please, and never, under any circumstances, pooping on a table. Besides, my poor obstetrician had already had to yank feces out of my intestines. Surely she had experienced enough of my poop to last a lifetime. When the next contraction started, I got shy. I tried to push without pooping. It was a bit like trying to do a squat without using any thigh muscles. The contraction ended, but no one cheered. This went on for at least an hour. Every now and then, I would let go of my inhibition and push with all the muscles usually responsible for pooping. My doctor and nurse would hoot and holler and tell me to do it again. Then I would go back to worrying about pooping on the table, and for the next several contractions, I would try to push out the baby while preserving my dignity. About 2 hours into active labor, after a successful push, the doctor said, "I can see it. I can see the top of your daughter's head. Nathan, do you want to come see?" "No," I thought. "He does not." We had discussed this and agreed he might be forever scarred if he looked at my lady parts during labor. But before I could register what he was doing, Nathan had scooted away from me and looked. "She has hair! Lots of dark hair!" When he returned to my side, he was trembling with excitement and looked radiant. As I watched, he transformed. One moment, he was a theoretical father. The next, he was an actual dad, head over heels in love with his daughter. My heart skipped several beats, but at the same time, I was jealous of Nathan. He looked radiant, but I felt empty and hollow inside. The pain of active labor had drained away all my good feelings. Now that she had crowned, I assumed Pippa was seconds away from arriving. After all, that's how it happens in the movies. Movies lie. For another hour, I pushed and pushed and felt contractions ripping my body apart. Then, after nearly 3 hours of active labor, I accepted the truth. In order to push my baby into the world, I would have to poop all over the place. But I was exhausted and felt too defeated and pathetic to push. As if she was reading my thoughts, my obstetrician said, "Courtney, you can push for 10 more minutes, and then I have to do a C-section." What? A C-section? After 3 hours of this hell? I pushed and roared and pushed and forgot about everything but the contractions and the pushing. It did not matter how much poop got on the doctor. 10 minutes later, the nurse placed Pippa on my chest. I had been anticipating this moment for 9 months. It was the moment the heavens would part, and fireworks would erupt, and everything would be more joyful than I could possibly imagine. The hospital ceiling stayed intact. No fireworks exploded. And though I searched for it, I could find no joy. But here was my baby, my daughter Pippa. So I looked down at her and tried to memorize the moment. Her eyes were wide open and dark blue, almost navy. And from the way she looked at me, she seemed already to know that I was her mama. My eyes glided down her body, head covered with black hair, plump lips, little scrunched up shoulders, legs that seemed impossibly long for someone so small, and toes that were absolutely perfect. I wanted to hold this tiny creature forever, but I could hold her for only a moment. Then a nurse whisked Pippa away to be poked and measured. My doctor smiled apologetically. "I'm sorry, Courtney, but I need you to put your legs back in the stirrups so you can deliver the placenta." Nathan shouted updates from the other side of the room. "She's beautiful! 10 fingers! 10 toes! Oh, her ears, they are so cute! She is amazing! So amazing! They are putting her on the scale! She weighs 7 pounds and 12.5 ounces. Some sort of enthusiasm from the mother seemed warranted, but I could think only about how much my legs hurt. "Do you want to see the placenta?" "Not really." But before I could react, the doctor was holding my placenta high in the air, directly in my line of vision. It looked very Game of Thrones. The doctor told me I had second-degree tears. The vaginal muscles had ripped during delivery. Try not to dwell on that point if you can. I need you to keep your feet in the stirrups a little longer, she said, so I can stitch you up, but you can hold Pippa while I work. A nurse returned Pippa to my arms, but my entire body was shaking from exhaustion. Nathan, please hold her and give her some skin-to-skin contact. I did not want to drop my newborn. Nathan removed his shirt and sat down on a chair about 5 feet from the hospital bed. He placed Pippa tenderly against his chest and held a blanket over her to keep her warm. After a moment, he laughed. She's trying to latch on me. You can try, baby girl, but I promise you won't get any milk from me. I laughed as if this were the most magical moment of my life. Inside, I felt empty. What was wrong with me? During that moment, when I was one of the newest mothers in the world, I thought I must be some sort of monster. But now, after lots of reflection, I know the truth. Nothing was wrong with me. I felt empty because I had given my all to bring my daughter into the world. The epidural had worn off when I needed it the most. My feet had been up in stirrups for over 3 hours, and my vaginal muscles had ripped. My feeling of emptiness was a vast improvement over the pain, misery, and fear of childbirth. Still, I'd expected to feel some emotional fireworks upon meeting my daughter. Wasn't this supposed to be love at first sight? Well, it was love at first sight, or rather, love at first sound. But that moment had happened 3 trimesters ago in my obstetrician's office, when I'd heard Pippa's heartbeat for the first time. The obstetrician had moved the ultrasound machine's transducer probe around my bare stomach, a frown creasing her brow, and then her face had relaxed. She turned up a dial, and the sound of a galloping heartbeat had filled the room. My baby's heartbeat. My heart had done somersaults, and my lung had felt so full, it was as if I might float all the way home. My baby, my baby! After that, I was fully in love with my baby. Erfi's subsequent kick and ultrasound made my heart expand a little more. I did not need to see or touch my baby, and I certainly did not need to experience any fireworks to be in love. But in the delivery room, looking at Pippa for the first time, I did not have the energy or capacity to think those things. All I could think about was how my reaction to Pippa's birth fell short of the Hollywood standard. Meanwhile, my hormones were busy crashing. During pregnancy, my estrogen and progesterone levels had been much higher than usual. Within the next 24 hours, they would plummet back to their normal levels. For some women, this hormonal crash is a trigger for postpartum depression. I had never done well with hormonal fluctuations. I could handle PMS, but the birth control pill had nearly destroyed me. When Nathan and I were first dating, I took one brand of the pill for a year, and even though my obstetrician at the time told me I would bleed a lot less during menses, my menstrual flow instead became even stronger. I tried switching to a different brand, but that only increased the intensity of the bleeding and, worse, gave me dramatic mood swings that made me cry hysterically, usually at dawn to Nathan's delight, and for no reason at all. After 6 months on the second brand, I decided to quit, and the next time my period started, it was as if I had never taken the pill. Looking back now, it seems so obvious. My body was sensitive to hormonal changes, and I already had plenty of pre-existing issues with anxiety. Of course I was going to have postpartum depression. All I wanted to do was hold Pippa in my arms forever. After the doctor had sewed up my battle wounds, I had reclaimed my baby and held her for a second time. This time I maneuvered her toward my chest, and she eagerly latched onto a nipple and started to suck. Oh, thank goodness, I thought. She is breastfeeding. I will be a good mother. I ran a fever during the last hour of labor, so when Pippa was done breastfeeding, the nurse whisked her away for 2 hours of observation in the nursery. An orderly wheeled me to a room in the maternity ward where Nathan and I promptly crashed. But even asleep, I could sense that something was missing. I woke up exactly 2 hours and 7 minutes after the nurses took Pippa away for observation and shouted for Nathan, still asleep, to get our baby back. I know. It is so weird that I can remember that Pippa was gone for 2 hours and 7 minutes and yet have no idea what I had for lunch yesterday. Pippa seemed to have gotten more beautiful while she was gone. I could not get over her almond-shaped eyes. When she was awake, I studied the color of her irises. When she closed her eyes, I marveled at her dark, dark lashes. Nathan had a hard time convincing me to put her back in the cradle so I could get more sleep. My parents and Grandma Shirley arrived in the late morning for the beginning of hospital visiting hours. Pippa had turned them into first-time grandparents and a brand-new great-grandma. As soon as Pippa seemed to be done breastfeeding, I proudly passed her to my mom. This seemed like a good time to feel some excitement. All I could think about were my bowels. I had started obsessing over my need to move my bowels a few hours ago, about 7 hours into motherhood. Of course, at that point, I had nothing to poop. I had taken care of that situation on the delivery table. That did not stop my anxiety from turning constipation into an obsession. While my parents and grandma gushed over Pippa, my brain fretted. When would I poop? Was I already constipated? Would I need manual extraction again? What if that didn't work? I did my best to ignore the questions and enjoy our visitors. Pippa was lying stomach down across my mom's legs, getting her first back massage to relieve gas. I thought I should be bouncing with excitement. After all, I had been so happy to tell my parents and siblings that I was pregnant. But now that my parents were here, snapping photos, and my siblings were sending excited emails and texts, the excitement felt so far away, it might as well have never happened. Only the threat of constipation felt real. By afternoon, I was certain that I had to poop. I devoured a large breakfast, an even larger lunch, and multiple desserts. But every time I tried to have a bowel movement, I got nervous. Could I burst the stitches the doctor had sewn into me if I pushed too hard? Then I would imagine my bladder tumbling into the toilet and abandon the effort. I got angry with myself. I was supposed to be bonding with my daughter, not worrying about my bowels. Surely all other mothers gracefully navigated these first postpartum hours. I berated myself as if I were spending every minute in the laboratory. That was hardly the case. The first day of Pippa's life, I spent all of 15 minutes away from her. Most of the time she was in my arms, napping, breastfeeding, or both. I sang her lullabies, admired her toes, and cooed whenever she opened her eyes. My first day as a mother was mostly tender and sweet. My anxiety about constipation, however, was an ever-present vibration in my personal atmosphere. It did not prevent me from bonding with Pippa, but it did keep my body humming with an edge of fear. And what had started as a single buzzing bee in the morning turned into an angry hive by day's end. Around midnight, 24 hours after I had given birth, the night nurse tiptoed in to check my vital signs. Pippa was asleep in a cradle at the foot of my bed. Nathan was snoring on a cot near the door. "Please," I whispered, not wanting to wake husband or infant. "I still haven't had a bowel movement, and constipation was a big problem during pregnancy, and I know from the way I feel that I'm going to need an enema." I had mentioned the constipation issue at least a half dozen times to the day nurse, who was not impressed. The night nurse was much more sympathetic. She offered to fetch me a stool softener, and I gratefully accepted. I thought I was solving an immediate medical concern, and that was indeed the case. But on a deeper, darker level, my anxiety, previously manageable, was increasing so much it was interfering with my basic needs. Pippa and Nathan were both fast asleep. Exhausted from childbirth, I should have been sleeping as well. Yes, I felt a twinge of constipation, but the discomfort was on par with an itchy knee. The situation could have waited until morning. It was probably mostly a figment of my imagination. The anxiety that had always been so manageable, that had given me the edge that made me a successful student and lawyer, had tipped into a new territory. It was going to take a lot more than a stool softener to make me feel better. "Can I still hold her?" The nurse nodded curtly. "Yes, of course. You can take her out for feedings, but the rest of the time she needs to be wrapped in the blanket. Make sure the eye mask stays in place." Nathan transferred Pippa from her cradle to my arms. The billy blanket was made from thick, clear plastic. It was plugged into the wall and glowed blue. The blanket crunched as I tried to find a comfortable position. I studied Pippa's face. Her face still looked pink to me, but according to her blood test results, it was actually tinged yellow with jaundice. It had been less than 9 hours since the nurse had given me a stool softener, and already my anxiety had found a new way to stay busy. The paper mask covered half of Pippa's face, so I stroked the top of her head, the only part of her body I could safely touch without compromising the light therapy. "Babe, that doesn't look comfortable," said Nathan. He was sitting on a fabric folding chair of armrests and cup holders that we had brought from home. "It's not," I sighed. "How am I supposed to get skin-to-skin contact? I'm supposed to get as much as possible. It's important for breastfeeding. You got plenty of skin-to-skin with her yesterday, and you'll get tens more whenever she needs to nurse." "I guess so," I said. I let Nathan put her back in the cradle and turn off the light so I could try to nap. In the dark, the billy blanket glowed an even deeper, more brilliant shade of blue. "She looks like something out of a sci-fi movie," Nathan said. "She's our little sci-fi burrito." My heart was pounding as I tried to rest. At least Pippa had to be a sci-fi burrito for only one day. The insurance company had decided it was time for my discharge, but the pediatrician wanted Pippa to stay in the nursery for another night. The billy blanket had not been intense enough. Pippa needed extra therapy from a light box, a big clear container with a lamp at the top. It looked a lot like the sort of contraption that cooked churros and pretzels at the zoo. This was not part of the plan. We were all supposed to go home together, as a family of three. Nathan and I were not supposed to abandon our baby. You can stay until midnight if that makes you feel better, a maternity nurse suggested. Yes, I nodded. And then we could come back at 3 to breastfeed Pippa. I looked to Nathan for approval. Whatever you want, babe, he said. The nurse said, that's fine if you want, but you also need your sleep. We already have to give Pippa formula to help with the jaundice. You can come back in the morning after you have slept. I hesitated. It was as if the room were crowded with the ghosts of breastfeeding experts, all of them wagging their fingers at me, urging me to be strong and not miss a single feeding. But I was so tired. I'd gone into labor a little before midnight on Saturday. I had labored all day Sunday, giving birth a little after midnight on Monday. Pippa had been the sci-fi burrito on Tuesday. Now it was Wednesday, and I could not remember the last time I had slept longer than 3 hours in a single stretch. My body needed some deep, restorative sleep. We'll be back at 6, I said. Pippa would miss only one nursing session. I could wake up at 3 and pump. But once we got home, shortly after midnight, I could not bear the idea of setting up the pump and all of its bits and pieces. Surely the universe would forgive me if I let myself have a little uninterrupted sleep. I set my alarm for 6 in the morning and closed my eyes, assuming I would be asleep in seconds. Except my body was too wired to sleep. For 2 hours, I tossed and turned. The authorities had warned me to sleep whenever I could, but no one had told me what to do when a toxic mixture of guilt and anxiety for leaving my baby, for not stopping the jaundice, for not being a breastfeeding superstar, pressed so hard against my chest that sleep was impossible. By morning, the guilt and anxiety had spread until they had contaminated all my thoughts, as if someone had reprogrammed my brain and changed the default settings. When my alarm pinged, instead of yawning and hitting snooze, I leaped out of bed, or did the best approximation of a leap that a woman with second-degree vaginal tears can do, and woke Nathan. Now, on top of my guilt for abandoning Pippa, I felt guilty for waking Nathan. According to what the discharge nurse had told me the night before, we were right on time for Pippa's first feeding of the day. But by the time we got to the nursery, Pippa had already been fed and put back in the Blu-ray player. My anxiety soared. Go have breakfast, the nurse said, and come back in an hour. Then you can cuddle her as much as you like while we wait for the blood test results. The cafeteria was serving French toast covered with a tragic banana mush. As Nathan scraped away the mush, I felt responsible, because I had ordered my breakfast first. By choosing the French toast, I had given it my vote of confidence. Now poor Nathan was eating a revolting breakfast because of me. He hates me, I thought. He doesn't love me anymore. With every bite of breakfast, my adrenaline increased. We ate in silence. We had been together for nearly 5 years and spent hundreds of waking hours together in companionable silence, sitting on airplanes, floating around our pool, driving to Santa Barbara, waiting in lines at Disneyland, and in a myriad of other places. But this silence was terrifying. Why did they have to put this banana mush on the French toast? I said, feeling like the nerdiest girl at the bar making a pass at the movie star. I don't know, but it's disgusting. His tone of voice said, I agree, this banana mush sucks. But inside I winced and thought, he hates me. It's my fault this food is so gross. I felt an intense need to say something clever and interesting, as if our entire relationship depended on it. It's like cat vomit. Yep, Nathan said. We were doomed. Or at least that was how the postpartum depression made me feel. I had no idea that I had postpartum depression, but looking back, I know that's what was happening. I cannot pinpoint the exact moment my symptoms turned into an illness. It's a bit like trying to determine when a snowball becomes an avalanche, but I strongly believe the snowball first started rolling as I tried to push Pippa into the world. By the time we were having breakfast in the hospital cafeteria, I had entered the postpartum depression zone. Postpartum depression is a tricky illness. In the past, when I'd had a cold or the flu, I felt miserable, but was still the same person. The common cold never made me question my relationship with Nathan. The flu did not make me hyperanalyze everything about his body language, down to the way he breathed. But that was what postpartum depression did. Practically overnight, it shattered my sense of relief. When we were dating, I often drove myself crazy with doubts about Nathan's love for me. Thank you, Sex and the City. But those doubts have been gone for several years. My postpartum hormones resurrected long-dormant fears and increased their intensity by a power of 10. Instead of seeing my sweet, loving husband, I saw a man who emanated hatred and disdain for his lazy failure of a wife. And the postpartum depression was only getting started. Okay, I think that's about all my mouth and jaw can handle for this session, but I'm going to keep cranking these out. I really want to get this out into the world by the end of June. I don't want to torture you with if you want to hear the next chapters, I don't want to make you wait for days and days. So I will keep going and plugging away at this, But if you can't wait till the end of June to hear it all, head over to Amazon and you can get your copy of the ebook or the paperback. I'm keeping the prices as low as Amazon will let me. And you can also head over to my website, ppdadventures.com. And right there on the first page, there's, you know, written in bold, it says, you know, click here and you can get, it sends you to book funnel to the download page, and you can download your free copy of the ebook, because I really do just want to share my book with the world and hopefully get some reviews. If you're enjoying the book, or if you've already read it and you enjoyed it, it would mean so, so much if you wrote a review over on Goodreads or Amazon. That helps other moms find the book, and so it's an act of advocacy, helping to crush the stigma of maternal mood disorders. All right, thanks, and I'll be back soon with moving forward to chapter 6.